What exactly is meant by the New World Order? What was the form of cyber warfare used to execute the attacks of 9/11 that was consistently ignored by authorities, including the mainstream press? Does the billionaire class overcome basic science by paying the scientists and PR firms? Will the technocrats succeed in gaining freedom for themselves while enslaving the rest of us, or can this trend be overcome? This week on the Global Research News Hour, we focus the spotlight on longtime friend and colleague James Corbett, host of the Corbett Report, on the arrival of his brand new book, Reportage, Essays on the New World Order, a book that explores the podcaster's journey through the many topics that should concern listeners, but that is ignored and suppressed in mainstream media, including the false flag theory of 9/11 attacks, the control by elites of both the left and the right, and the capture of science and environmental concerns, and much, much more. On this week's program, Reportage, Essays on the New World Order, a conversation with author James Corbett. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of June 27th, 2025. The program is funded by the Center for Research on Globalization, produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. I'm your host, Michael Welch. The show seeks to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our shows are available to partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and available for streaming or download at the site Global Research. We acknowledge that this program was produced on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, the Innu, the Ojibwe, the Dene, and the Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. The history of Turtle Island, which we call North America, was written by European settlers who took this land through violence, broken treaties, and false promises. To gain justice for everyone, we cannot ignore the injustices committed against Indigenous people while we still continue with institutions of social and economic order set up to favor one side only. We should all make reparations and begin the process of reconciling our two peoples to a morally sound path. Now it's time for News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Listeners should know that some of the articles may run against common messaging about sensitive subjects and are not all endorsed by this radio station.
Iranians must understand, and many no doubt do, that the Western political class has been criminalized. Just as the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, or OPCW, is a corrupt agency which enabled the downfall of Syria and the installation of an Al-Qaeda junta, so too is the International Atomic Energy Agency, or IAEA, corrupt. Iranian Parliament Speaker Mohammad Bagher Ghalibaf correctly assessed on June 23rd that, quote, "the world clearly saw that the IAEA has failed to uphold its commitments and has turned into a political instrument," unquote. Furthermore, sources indicate close cooperation between the IAEA and Israel, which allowed or enabled Israel to assassinate Iranian scientists. Instead of being a neutral arbitrator, the IAEC has facilitated the Zionist Israel's war crimes against Iran. That comes from the article on the criminality of the West's, quote, "class politique," unquote. They do not want democracy in Iran, quote, "a puppet government just like its Al-Qaeda puppet in Syria," unquote. By Mark Taliano, posted June 25th. This outrageous 5% spending target didn't come out of nowhere. It's the direct result of years of bullying by Donald Trump. During his first term, Trump repeatedly berated NATO members for not spending enough on their militaries, pressuring them to meet a 2% GDP threshold that was already controversial and so excessive that nine NATO countries still fall below that quote-unquote target. Now, with Trump back in the White House, NATO leaders are falling in line, setting a staggering 5% target that even the United States, already spending over $1 trillion a year on its military, doesn't reach. This is not defense. It's extortion on a global scale, pushed by a president who views diplomacy as a shakedown and war as good business. Countries across Europe and North America are already slashing public services, and yet they are now expected to funnel even more taxpayer money into war preparation. That comes from the article, NATO's 5% Pledge, an obscene betrayal of global needs, by Madia Benjamin, posted June 26th. Trump's confidence in U.S. capabilities may be based on misleading briefings, especially regarding effectiveness of air defenses, accuracy and capability of bunker buster strikes. Iran's engineers are likely aware of U.S. strike doctrines and have probably designed facilities accordingly. Targeting and destroying such bunkers is much harder than presented, and success requires extremely accurate intelligence and direct hit capability, which may not exist. Overall, the faith in bunker buster success is questionable, and U.S. political leaders may be basing decisions on overly optimistic or flawed assumptions. That comes from the write-up under the headline, Video, Trump's Failed B-2 Adventure. The Bunker Buster Bomb Myth, MIT Professor Ted Postel and Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Davis, by Dr. Theodore Postel and Daniel Davis, posted June 26th, originally appearing on Daniel Davis Deep Dive. Both U.S. intelligence agencies and the International Atomic Energy Agency, or IAEA, recently confirmed that there's no evidence of an active nuclear weapons program in Iran. Until 1979, Iran was part of the Western camp and was even allowed to develop a nuclear program. But after the 1979 revolution, it became an enemy of the West, and both the U.S. and Israel sought regime change. Since regime change has so far failed and seems unlikely for now, the U.S.-Israel axis is attempting to neutralize Iran as a regional subpower. The long-term goal in the Middle East is to fragment countries into smaller, weaker entities that can no longer operate independently, ideally governed by pro-Western forces. That comes from the article, The Hidden Agenda Behind Trump's Attack on Iran, by Mark Vandepiet, posted June 26th. Broader analysis of what the British, French, and German spokespersons said at the onset of the war indicates that Israel's actions not only had the approval of the United States, but also were carefully coordinated with the Western states and most likely with NATO as well. The central objective of the effort was to destabilize the Iranian government and to create internal chaos and conflict, which ultimately would bring about full-scale internal fragmentation and the collapse of the country. Despite the deep and unexpected consequences felt in the first few hours of the Israeli attack, which left Iran in a state of shake and shock, the country's leaders quickly restored their synergy, resolved their challenges, organized their military forces, and prepared to carry out appropriate countermeasures. Marked by a massive missile and drone attack against Israel, leading to widespread destruction of its infrastructure and economic system, the situation quickly shifted to what surprised all, including Western countries, a united national stance and coordinated reaction both from inside the country and worldwide In response to the aggression, Iranians united across the country and pledged for resilience and resistance against an aggressor who had already been labeled on Iranian media as, quote, the Middle East butcher, unquote. That comes from the article, Iran, the regime change war was a, quote, joint plan, unquote, by Amin Arman, posted June 25th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. My involvement with CKUW and community radio began with my work as an activist. I had been involved with working against the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. I also became involved with trying to mobilize opposition to the Security and Prosperity Partnership, a mechanism seeking to merge regulatory standards in a variety of fields across Canada, the United States, and Mexico, which many believed would erase our sovereignty. As an activist, I had been accustomed to answering reporter questions, but when I appeared on CKUW, I found I had a lot more room and time to speak than I did with any of the other reporters I dealt with. After I was finished, my interviewer asked me if I would be interested in joining CKUW and take a short number of workshops. I didn't know if I had the time, but I decided to work it into my schedule. By the time I was finished and met some of the other programmers, I liked the rapport I felt with them, and before long I felt like I had become part of the team. As a news person, I tended to focus on local people who I felt were not getting adequate attention in the mainstream broadcasts, but I also found that CKUW was remarkable in its willingness to give airtime to people skeptical of the official story of the September 11th terrorist attacks, 9/11. When I got on my own radio station, my own radio show, I dove into the opportunity to get these facts out there. Likewise, information about the war in Afghanistan and the war in Iraq, while the mainstream repeated claims of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, for example, CKUW was already questioning this contention. Before long, after receiving a call from Michelle Chosadovsky, head of Global Research, I worked my broadcast strategy into a podcast. And for the following 12 years, I worked every week to bring skeptical inquiry about subjects of war, politics, and economics to your broadcast ears on the show Global Research NewsHour, all of which these subjects were commonly dismissed by the broad media. While this subject may have been challenging at times, I never looked back and found myself devoted to work that I never saw myself doing 2 decades ago. It stands to reason, therefore, that in a way, I find myself bonded in spirit to a certain podcaster. He was working for Global Research for a time, putting out excellent videos on the same subjects. He also was not aiming all his life to get cool videos and news up on the internet. It started following a nudge at his brain regarding the so-called conspiracy theories about 9/11, which, the more he probed, seemed to actually make sense. And he too found himself exploring all kinds of subjects, all bound together, not just by stuff the media won't talk about, but by what can be ascertained through a deep study of history, which also is left off the news pages. His work concludes that forces are at work to filter what we believed, to brainwash us, if you will, to enable power for themselves at the expense of the rest of us. That individual is known as James Corbett, and after 15 years of doing this kind of work, he has finally condensed a lot of his essays into a single accessible volume. His work is called
Reportage, Essays on the New World Order, published by Diversified Graphic LLC in Atlanta, Georgia. Among his many topics, the 9/11 whistleblowers, why we must oppose Bilderberg, escaping the grand chessboard, up-down politics, biotech billionaires and the GMO doomsday, selling your soul for a matrix stake, and the strange life of Maurice Strong. His foreword was written by Whitney Webb, author of One Nation Under Blackmail, who pointed to James as being among the most consistent, well-sourced, and credible voices in indie media, educating generations of truth-seekers. And Patrick Wood, author of Technocracy Rising, said that James wants to free your mind from the matrix and see for yourself the deception, the delusions, the endless propaganda, and unrelenting evil. James Corbett is a frequent guest on the Global Research News Hour and a good friend as well. I had a good chat with him this past Tuesday or Wednesday morning, Japan time, where he's located. So with all that being said, here is my interview with James Corbett, podcaster extraordinaire, on his book, Reportage, Essays on a New World Order. James Corbett is an award-winning journalist and documentary filmmaker who posts videos, articles, and interviews on his site, CorbettReport.com. He's a podcaster of international repute, and now I can also describe him as an author. His book, hot off the press, is called Reportage, Essays on the New World Order, a book that is 15 years in the making. So we're going to discuss it on this week's show. Thank you so much for joining us, James.
Thank you for having me on, Michael. I do appreciate it.
Your book has been available for a little over a month now, James. What kind of a reaction have you had so far from the public?
Well, actually, slight correction. My book has been available for about 4 or 5 months now. But I did have the official book launch about a month and a half ago. So far, I have received a lot of positive feedback on this. In fact, perhaps more than I was expecting. It turns out that after doing my podcast for 18 years and accruing an international audience, there were a lot of people that were hungry for a literary form of my expression. And I'm glad that they were, because I have always considered myself a writer first and never really thought I would ever be a podcaster. So perhaps this is a more natural format for me.
Well, that's one thing that did strike me. I mean, you're a writer. Writing was your original calling back in the 1990s, even though you're better known today as a podcaster. I mean, you trained in literature, got a master's degree in Irish literature, I think, and then you went off to Japan in 2006, and then you found a new calling, you know, following your investigations into 9/11. Why don't you give our listeners just the brief story behind your trip down the rabbit hole?
Well, this is all explained in my first opening essay of this book on adventures in the new media. But long story short, this was a rather mundane experience for me here in Japan, moving into a new apartment that happened to come with an internet connection. And it was the first time in years that I'd had an internet connection in my home. So instead of going to the internet cafe to connect once a week to download emails and maybe a podcast or two, suddenly I had the world at my fingertips. And it wasn't long before I started using that ability to essentially, well, I started by looking at just sort of basic political content along the lines of what I'd always grown up with and been accustomed to, The Daily Show and The Colbert Report and things along those lines. But it wasn't long before I started encountering information that I had not encountered either in my education, in the Canadian education system, or in any of my travels and travails in the wider world and in media and what have you. And it wasn't just information that was new and interesting. It was information that had obviously been occluded from my attention. One example that I can think of many, were the documentaries of Adam Curtis, BBC documentary filmmaker, but obviously growing up in Canada, I hadn't been exposed to his documentaries before. So encountering, for example, The Century of the Self, or documentaries along those lines, The Power of Nightmares, certainly gave me a different perspective on world events. And it wasn't long before I started finding a radically different perspective, looking into things like 9/11 truth or the origins of the Federal Reserve or central banking, things along those lines. And once I started tumbling down that rabbit hole, it was really the process not just of discovering the information, not just sort of passively accepting information, but starting to dig through archives and materials online to look for source documents. Once I started that search, I think that was really the snowball rolling downhill that led to the creation of the Corbett Report.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like you're in a way, I mean, my path has been similar. I mean, I found out about 9/11 and then some of the holes there and that weren't reflected anywhere else. I went down my own journey and I ended up doing podcasts and doing community radio, which is something that I'd never even thought of when I was a much younger person. But you do journalistic work, essentially. I mean, you are a journalist. And I was wondering, did you get any special training as a journalist, or has it been all self-taught?
Not only that, I mean, literally everything that I do is self-taught, including being a webmaster and all of the technical aspects of what I do, and of course the journalistic side of it as well. Although over the years, I really have wondered what it is exactly I am and what I do, because the word podcaster did not even exist when I was back in high school thinking, what am I going to do with my life? So it still seems strange to describe myself as a professional podcaster. And over the years of sort of casting about for the right terminology to try to describe what I do, I think I eventually landed on the idea of teacher. Because, of course, that was why I originally came to Japan, to be an English teacher. And so if there is something to the work that I'm doing, I think it's an educational enterprise. And I think of it in those terms. I am a teacher that is simply teaching information that I have encountered along the way that I think is important, and hopefully contextualizing it for people in a way that they can understand. And to the extent that the best journalists are able to do that, take and synthesize and then order and present information in an understandable and hopefully interesting way, then I guess that's what I'm aiming for, and that's what I'm attempting to do.
Well, yeah, I know. Also note that you source everything that you write. Your everything, even the videos, have a good range of sources that you get out there. So that's something that's I think even in podcasting, that's something that's a rare trait. But getting at the book. Your book covers, many different essays on 9/11, but they're also covering the flaws of following politics and then expecting you can vote your way out of tyranny or something like that, or the billionaire plans and controls, billionaire control over science, the environment, politicians, entertainment, and otherwise utilizing all of their resources to secure control, okay, and this technocratic control. I mean, is that essentially what you mean by the New World Order? Is that the thread that connects the essays together?
I think so. And yes, I very consciously did not specifically define that term, New World Order, although it is the subtitle of the book, Reportage, Essays on the New World Order. Nowhere in the book do you get a single definition of that phrase, because it means a lot of different things. There are a lot of different aspects to that. But in some ways, it is a very simple idea. It's the same as the old world order. It's the same idea that has persisted throughout the millennia of recorded human civilization, which is that a small group of people, an oligarchy, seeks to consolidate and centralize its power over as many people as possible. And I think we're seeing the 21st century manifestation of that in the oligarchical networks that so clearly control and direct the political stage show that is wielded or this put out in front of us, mostly to distract us from the fact that there is a very different way that the society is being ordered, and also to distract us from the fact that ultimately the entire system, everything that exists, really does exist on the back of our labor, on the back of the average worker and the average person who is creating this world really from the ground up. But we are taught our entire lives that all of this could not possibly exist without some sort of ruling government to rule over us and to steward this economy. And I think that is really the wool that's been pulled over our eyes, and something that I'm hoping to try to remove in various different ways with these essays.
Yeah. Well, and looking at a couple of the essays, I mean, on 9/11, for instance, you had a really good essay there. I mean, I thought I knew a lot about 9/11 already, but I mean, one interesting chapter is on PTECH, P-T-E-C-H, talking about cyber warfare that was involved in this attack being waged. There was someone named F. Indira Singh who was basically spilling the beans about the software being used actually by terrorist-backed groups and the government looking the other way and media getting away with it. I mean, can you just give our listeners a preview of that essay, if you could?
Absolutely. Indira Singh was a very interesting whistleblower who seems to have disappeared off the face of the earth, which is interesting in and of itself. But this essay in particular concerns itself with the story that she was relating in the early 2000s of her experience as a risk management officer at JP Morgan Chase, obviously a huge banking institution that takes risk management very seriously and has to look for all sorts of things and threats and money laundering and insider dealings and all sorts of potential threats to the banking business. So they take that very seriously. And in late 1990s, she was looking for enterprise architecture software to help with risk management. And this is the type of software that essentially can look at, it provides the God's eye view of an enterprise. Everything from employees and operations and project management, etc. Literally every aspect and every detail of what any sort of large scale enterprise like JP Morgan are doing. And it would be able to not only detect threats and problems within that system, but even predict them given enough data about what's going on in that system. So she was looking at this one company called PTECH that seemed to come with the exact right pedigree, because it was, in addition to serving some very large corporations, it served many different branches of the U.S. government, the FAA and NORAD and the FBI and IRS and et cetera, et cetera. Its list of clients were such as it definitely commended itself to Singh's attention. But once she met with these people, she started to get a very different impression of what this company was, and she started digging into the company and its background and found some of its very questionable links to people who were, for example, globally designated terrorists in the wake of 9/11. It turns out one of them happened to be one of the angel investors in this company, and it started to get into deeper and weirder waters as she continued this investigation, to the point where she, of course, started to raise some of the issues that she found with PTECH to the FBI, at which point an FBI agent told her that she was in a better position to investigate this company than they were at the FBI because of restrictions that were being placed on them in terms of their operations. So I will let people read the essay to find out how that plays out. But essentially, it ends up with what Michael Rupert, one of the original 9/11 truth researchers, talked about was the possibility that it was Cheney running some version of PTECH in the bowels of the Pentagon on 9/11, in the PEOC, specifically the Presidential Emergency Operations Center, because PTECH, as it turns out, had the systems that were coordinating and looking into the interoperability of FAA and NORAD systems right there in 2001. And those are the very systems that are implicated in the war games that were happening on 9/11 that just happened to be injecting fake radar blips onto screens that the NORAD tapes show were confusing FAA operators all morning. So there were some crazy things happening on 9/11 that still many, many people do not know anything about.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States.
You also mentioned about the 9/11 whistleblowers, and that there's been commentary that, it wasn't a conspiracy because somebody would have blabbed about it, right? But as you expertly demonstrate, I mean, people did blab, but they just went unnoticed. And I think that's principally, like, even including the 9/11 commissioners themselves, that's principally the fault of the mainstream media, though, isn't it?
I would say so, but I think there's a good degree of blame to go around on that front. And I look at specifically the professional skeptics of the skeptic class, people like Michael Shermer, who I quote in the essay, who do dismiss and poo-poo any suggestion of conspiracy because it couldn't possibly be true because no one could keep a secret. Someone would have blabbed. But as I go on to say in the essay, there are many, many people who had different aspects of the 9/11 story that they were attempting to ring the alarm bell about, like Barry Jennings, the deputy director of emergency services for the New York City Housing Authority, who was there in World Trade Center Building 7 in the emergency management office around the time that the second plane was slamming into the World Trade Center. He was in Building 7, which, as I hope your informed listeners know, was the third building to go down on 9/11, not hit by any plane, but it went down. He was in the building as the other buildings were being attacked, and he testified to explosions that were happening in WTC-7 and stepping over dead bodies to get out of there, etc., etc. He has a remarkable story, but he just happened to die literally just days before NIST released their draft report on what happened in WTC-7. So that was interesting. I talk about J. Michael Springman, who was a U.S. consulate officer in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, in the late 1980s, where he was unwittingly part of a visa for terrorists scheme that was being run by the CIA through that that U.S. consulate. And they were running essentially terrorists from Afghanistan into America for training on behalf of the CIA's golden boy at that time, Osama bin Laden, who, of course, was this valiant warrior against the Soviets back during the Afghan War and on the U.S. side. I talk about Richard Grove, who was working for Silverstream Software at that time and working with Martian McLennan, which was, of course, a WTC client or a tenant, on an incredibly large project, the biggest in Silverstream's history, to provide financial services linking up computer systems. He was attempting to blow the whistle on essentially the fact that Marsh seemed to be overbilling Silverstream to the tune of, or Silverstream was overbilling Marsh to the tune of several million dollars. He attempted to blow the whistle on it and was eventually forced out of his position for attempting to blow the whistle on that. He was called to a meeting on 9/11/2001 that was to be held on I can't remember which floor, the 90th floor or whatever it was, of the World Trade Center. And luckily, he was late that day, because if he had not been late for that meeting that day, he would be dead, along with every other single person who was called to that meeting. The person who actually called the meeting, the CEO or the executive who called the meeting, happened to not be in the building that day. I talk about Kevin Ryan, who worked for Underwriters Laboratories, which bragged about having certified the steel in the World Trade Center buildings, and then saying that they actually performed extremely well. The steel held up more than you could expect, considering all of that fireproofing was knocked off by the plane impact. When Kevin Ryan started asking questions and questioning his own company about this, he, of course, was summarily fired. And as you say, I also, of course, talk about the 9/11 commissioners themselves, because as people may or may not know, over half of the commission, in one way or another, called out the 9/11 commission as a cover-up, including, of course, the commission chairs, the co-chairs, Kane and Hamilton. They said we were set up to fail. Yes, exactly right. So there's a lot of people who have attempted to bring information about 9/11 that's well, goes against the official story, let's say.
Yeah, and there's also, I mean, it's not all just about 9/11, of course. I mean, there's a really good chapter about the biotech billionaires, and they control the science, essentially, and you demonstrate in a nutshell how they get the results that they want, you know, like the topic of glyphosate and the that's being used, you know, by the Bayer, Monsanto, GMO people. I mean, that's a classic example, and how the industry just paid the scientists to kind of do a bit of a flip and actually defeat some of the independent scientists. I mean, can you talk about that? Because I think it has implications for all sorts of fields in an age where, you know, people keep saying follow the science, but there's you know, this other element that interferes with it.
There certainly is. And yes, that's explicitly the point of that essay. And what I open up the essay with is pointing out that the people who say that those who reject genetically modified organism technology for foods and other such things are the anti-science kooks, because they have these weird anti-scientific arguments. No, the science says that GM is safe. But when you look into the science, you find out it is bought and paid for by a handful of biotech corporations. And I bring some receipts to that statement, talking, for example, about the experiments of Gilles-Éric Seralini, who is a French scientist at the University of Caen, who was publishing on the long-term toxicity of a Roundup herbicide and a Roundup-tolerant genetically modified maize, which was a peer-reviewed, published scientific article showing that rats that were fed glyphosate or glyphosate in combination with GM or just GM foods, all of them developed tumors at a drastically higher rate than rats that were not fed the glyphosate or GM food. And that was a pretty bedrock study that was immediately, after its publication, was immediately retracted through this incredibly bizarre process that I go into in the book about the editor being essentially on the payroll of various biotech companies, etc. And there was a lot of shenanigans that went on to undermine that study. And that's just one example of how this science has been shaped and engineered by these biotech corporations for the benefit of the biotech billionaires and in service of a much, much potentially darker agenda. As I go on to talk about the Svalbard seed vault in the Arctic, cut out of the frozen tundra of the Arctic, there is this seed vault in which they are storing all of the genetic material for heirloom seeds and all of these things in the event of, some kind of complete planetary disaster that ends all life on Earth. At least there will be this fail-safe seed vault that we'll be able to repopulate the Earth with. What exactly are they planning on? Oh, don't worry about it too much. But by the way, this is funded by the likes of the Gates and the Rockefellers and all of the usual eugenicists who are behind so many of these schemes.
Yeah, well, I just hope they don't put it to the test. But in another chapter, there's an interesting scenario. This is a more humorous one, and the story of a time traveler from the 1950s who meets a resident of the 2020s, and then you use that to back up arguments about how, I mean, with the use of the cell phones today, they're essentially cementing the loss of freedoms that back in my day was cemented as one of the evils of communism or something like that. I mean, this is about surveillance and how it's become, at least by my read of it, it's becoming, you know, carrying Big Brother and her cell phones and so on, it's becoming accessible, you know. Mm-hmm. We don't think about it anymore.
Yes.
Essentially, this is the essay, I guess, or, you know, part of a system of surveillance working its wonders and you know, making us sort of immune, numb, comfortably numb, to quote Pink Floyd, to what's going on around us.
I think so. And yes, I'm sure we've all had that thought of thinking, wow, you know, if this thing that's happening today had happened 20 years ago or 30 years ago or 50 years ago, people would not have stood for it. But for some reason, people have been just led along by the nose bit by bit until things that were unthinkable become thinkable. And so that was sort of the genesis of this idea. So what if we brought someone from the 1950s into today and they saw all of the, for example, the way that we carry around these smartphone fondle slab devices everywhere we go that is tracking everywhere we go and recording us in all sorts of different ways and sending this information to companies and governments and what have you. And everyone is so completely blasé about it, it seems like it doesn't even matter. Whereas if you had introduced that concept to someone in the 1950s, well, of course, that's what the commies do. We wouldn't do that here in the land of the free. So that was sort of the genesis. And it's hopefully a sort of fun way of framing the idea. But it's, of course, a very serious idea. And I get into the concept of Orwell and the boot on the face forever, 1984 Big Brother tyranny versus Huxley and the Soma of the Brave New World, and how people can actually be made to enjoy their servitude, as Aldous Huxley was warning about or salivating about, I'll let you decide for yourself, in his 1962 lecture on the Ultimate Revolution.
Yeah, well, I won't, you know, blow it, but I mean, just some of the interactions there are kind of funny. I think, you know, again, the themes of one of the essays, there's the recognition of mainstream media's complicity in the subversion of humanity. I mean, not just, you know, not telling certain stories, but the repetitions of the labels conspiracy theory, and even scientists and doctors who speak out, you know, who are speaking on a distant level, speaking out on issues of a technical nature or whatever, faced with the same sort of treatment and even, you know, losing appeal in that direction. But what do you think is the most outrageous example that you can think of the way media and the billionaire class work hand in hand, hand in glove, to deal with dissident thinking?
You know, I suppose since I have been covering this in one form or another for the entirety of the Corbett Report's 18 years of existence, it's hard for me to narrow it down to one or two examples. But I would say the one that should be freshest in all of our minds is the craziness that we've seen over the past 5 years. I don't write a great deal about it in the book, but I certainly have talked about it at length on my podcast, about the way that we were expected to, of course, follow the science in 2020, 2021, 2022. Failure to follow the science would result in such things as, oh, I don't know, having your YouTube channel of nearly 600,000 subscribers completely deleted off the face of the internet. Although I will parenthetically note that the Corbett Report was mysteriously and weirdly put back on YouTube just a month ago. So anyway, I'm back on YouTube, everybody. I wouldn't expect to be there very long, but I'm here for the moment. Anyway, that to me was the most insidious example and the most blatant example of this amalgamation of not just governmental censorship, not just media censorship, not just institutional, but this amalgamation of all of these things working together in concert, in lockstep, as it were. And of course, I use that word advisedly for those who know about the Rockefeller Foundation report on lockstep and their prediction of various events like a potential pandemic that will shut down the world that they were writing about in 2010. But yes, we saw the lockstep of the WHO and the CDC and the US government and the UK government and every government around the world and all of these institutions essentially conspiring to shut down any scientific dissent. We're not just talking about wild-eyed, crazy conspiracy loonies like myself. We're talking about actual, real-deal doctors and scientists who had very, very real and valid and now legitimated concerns about various aspects of what took place, including, of course, the vaccines and everything else. Now it is okay to talk about such things, and now it seems like, okay, there is some degree of free speech that is being restored or allowed at this time. But for the last few years, it was, of course, verboten to talk about these subjects. That, to me, should be a bright clarion call for anyone who is concerned about, for example, science. If you actually care about science, you should be very, very concerned about the fact that they attempted to completely shut down all scientific debate in the name of science. It's absolutely ridiculous and completely contradictory, but it happened. And I think until we have a real reckoning of that and why and how that happened, we will not be able to actually stop it from happening again.
Well, I the thing is, you're pointing to something that actually, in a way, I was kind of disappointed a little in terms of your book, because there was a general lack of discussion about the COVID situation, actually. I mean, with all the lockdowns, the masking, and the embrace of the vaccine, or the so-called vaccine based on emergency use authorization and all of that, and attempts to normalize it all. I mean, to many of us, your podcasts were, you know, a sane place where all the facts are laid out, and that comforted a lot of folks, and where there is a difference of opinion, who were called unscientific conspiracy theorists and anti-vaxxers and all the rest of it. I mean, your show drove up the popularity of your podcast, I believe. I mean, more people were getting a lot of hits, but you also got, well, for, you know, until now, yanked off of YouTube and perhaps other platforms as well. Maybe you got a a little
Patreon specifically. Yeah.
Like that. But I mean, we're seeing the full weight of this violation of liberties globally, and that's what you've been arguing for, essentially. You know, that's that up down thing, you know, authoritarianism versus libertarianism, and yet your book doesn't really mention it. And I mean, the word COVID is only mentioned 6 times in the whole book, as asides, really, and once only in a footnote. So I'm just wondering, you know, why you would choose to leave out any essays dealing specifically with COVID-19 and biosecurity and the pandemic treaty and other matters. Why it's still, it didn't make it to print.
Well, the only essay that specifically deals with it is A Letter to the Future, which was written in April of 2020 and specifically about the events as they were unfolding and where they were heading towards. And so I think that that does serve as a testament to those dark times and what they meant. But this is a reflection of the fact that this book, I'm not joking when I say this book was started in 2009. Literally, the first essays in this were started in 2009, and I've been working on it in various forms over that 15-year span from 2009 to 2024. And so in a way, it would have been perhaps a lie of sorts if I suddenly in 2020, 21, 2, 3, suddenly made the entire book about COVID. It would have been easy to do that. Maybe I should do an entire book about the events of that. But this is not that book. This is a book that is meant to be the scope and breadth of everything that I cover and think about, including philosophy and politics and globalism and history and science and economics and all of the things in between. So I like to think it's reflective of that broad span of things that I talk about. But also, I think, in a way, perhaps rather than hitting the nail directly on the head like that, in that very obvious way, maybe it's more important that we have the groundwork of things like, for example, my essay on the real meaning of independence, or on up-down politics, or on the biotech billionaires essay, so that people understand the philosophical groundwork from which I'm coming from, talking about human freedom and why it's important. I think that is the base that we need in order to protect ourselves from COVID-like events in the future. If people were informed about issues like that, were thinking about philosophical and political issues in that way, I think it would be a lot harder to trick the population into simply locking themselves down and doing whatever the authorities say in the name of the science.
Okay, well, I understand you have to depart soon to partake in another interview, but maybe just say anything else about the book that you really want to stress, something that you would like to express about just before you depart.
I guess I would just like to say that this book really is my attempt at not encapsulating everything that I have done or do at the Corbett Report, but at any rate, I think it gives a pretty good example and swath of the type of work that I do and the type of topics that I cover. Again, everything from media criticism to talking about the Bilderberg Group to talking about hidden history and the deep state and talking about false flag events and political philosophy and science and environmentalism and all of these sorts of things. There's a lot that is covered in this book. And perhaps the most important part of this, for people who already know and are familiar with my work, I guarantee you there will be things in here that you will learn from this book. But perhaps even more importantly, I'd like to think that this book it will reach people that, for example, my podcasts and videos will not. If you send your average friend who knows nothing about these things, some crazy conspiracy guy's weird videos on, you know, whatever, some weird Odyssey or Rumble platform or something, they can easily dismiss that. A physical book in physical form is a lot harder to dismiss. And I hope that these essays are written in a way that they will be digestible, at any rate, by people who are not already informed on these issues and that might draw them into further exploration at the Corbett Report or Global Research or any other source of independent media news. So I'd like to think of this as my emissary to the world, and I hope people will use it as such. Maybe if you have a copy, lend it out to a friend. And hopefully it is easy to do so because it is structured as a bunch of essays that can be read in any order. You can read any one. You could recommend someone, hey, guy, just read this one essay here and let me know what you think. And you never know, they might end up reading the whole book.
And how can our listeners get a copy of your book?
The best place to go is reportagebook.com. There you can find all of the various, well, you can find many of the various ways that you can buy it. But of course, if you have a local bookstore, a mom and pop bookstore, if such things even exist, brick and mortar bookstores, you can order this from any bookstore through the ISBN number that is on reportagebook.com. You just show them the ISBN number. They'll be able to order it for you. So why not support an actual physical bookstore if you happen to be blessed with one in your area?
James, it has been an absolute pleasure to interview you and to read this book. And if it becomes a real big hit, maybe you could follow up with a work of fiction or volume two or something like that.
I have ideas. Let's put it this way. I didn't start a literary imprint for no reason. I do have an imprint now, Edition Shukuto, that this is published under. So, you know, there may be things in the future.
James Corbett is the award-winning writer, journalist, and documentary producer and hosts the site CorbettReport.com. And his recent book is entitled Reportage, Essays on the New World Order.
As James Corbett drives home particularly well in his book, is his reporting on the way our society is using technology such as artificial intelligence and clever surveillance devices such as our cell phones, and psychologically sophisticated techniques such as what dominates modern television, to not only stifle our resistance, but to even have the desire to resist. Consider, for example, the current genocide of the people of Gaza, tens of thousands dead, or the outrageous amount of money to go to the military while our own citizens cannot afford rent, while water on indigenous reserves is still unaddressed, while more and more people are trying to cope with overdosing on drugs like fentanyl. Our reactions seem to be subdued, almost as if we are becoming insensitive to the state's violence against us. This is what figures such as Elon Musk seek to bring about as an endpoint, a utopia known as a technocracy. Basically, a government where control of society or industry is run by technical experts, where the will of the people does not decide our fates. The elites shape the will of the people, and democracy is therefore absent. A number of these scenarios have played out in science fiction pieces. For example, George Orwell's 1984 and Aldous Huxley's Brave New World. But one of the works that most ardently addresses these issues in an alarming way, in my opinion, is the 1960s British television series known as The Prisoner. It was a masterful allegory starring actor Patrick McGoohan in a story about a fellow in intelligence who resigned from his position and was about to set on a trip overseas. Unfortunately, someone in authority wanted to extract information that he had, so he was gassed while in his abode, and when he woke up, he found that he had been abducted and taken to a strange place called The Village. It had all sorts of accoutrements of modern society. There was a city council, a newspaper, vast forms of recreation, a countryside, a beach on an ocean, except you can never leave. If you try to exit, a guardian called Rover, that looks like a giant white beach ball, pursues you and drags you back into the village. What the character on the show found that was what united the people in the community was information that they held needed to be extracted. The population of the village eventually either accepted the reality they were living with as normal, or they may have perished in seeking an escape. Only this main character, acting and speaking as an individual, refused to willingly sacrifice anything to his kidnappers. The person working in charge of the village was named Number Two, and this person changed each week, foiling the plans of his adversary to gain dominion over the prisoner's resolve was his weekly challenge. Patrick McGoohan's character was never named. He only went by the number he was given and rejected. number 6. The final two episodes were written and directed by McGoohan himself, and in fact, he was also the executive producer, which goes to show his personal devotion to the project. In the penultimate episode, Once Upon a Time, with hallucinogenic drugs, psychological manipulation, isolation, deception, and other dramatic measures being tried and failing, number 6 was dragged through an emergency measure called Degree Absolute, in which number 2 put him through all of his experiences in life, from birth to school to university to athletics to his time working in intelligence, and all the while number 2 was right there trying to break him. When the prisoner held fast through it all, he was permitted to pass through the charade and finally meet number 1. This is where the show got totally bizarre, because in the final episode, Fallout, and some spoiler warning for listeners who may not have watched the show yet, he sat in a chair in front of an audience full of people wearing masks and white robes and who were dressed exactly alike and applauding the prisoner. Each one of the powers that be is represented by a different organizational dynamic. For example, education, entertainment, recreation, old folk, anarchism, and so on, but all looked externally exactly the same. The music in the background was peculiar and out of sync with the serious events in unfolding, a version of the gospel classic Dry Bones. When he finally got the chance to meet number 1, the person who ran the entire village, number 1, like the other people, wore a white robe and a mask. When the prisoner took the mask off number 1, he found the defiant and menacing visage of himself. Who controlled the man's fate and his journey and his freedom? He did, or at least he should. Back to Corbett's book. In the chapter entitled A Brief Introduction to Spontaneous Order, James Corbett spoke about how when systems fall apart in society, the people have the ability to negotiate the scenario on their own, and curiously, there is actually more order when this happens. Traffic intersections, for example, do not leave us all as helpless as we are led to believe in our society. So maybe we don't need police. Maybe we don't need people telling us what to do or how to behave. Maybe, just maybe, we can function adequately and even better without the politicians. Maybe your number 1 and my number 1 and millions of others can arrive at a dramatically different outcome than what all our powerful profit-making operatives have accomplished. The specter of the technocratic police state seems to threaten to be with us regardless of who we vote for, and intensify. Rather than continue down this path to the inevitable result of feudalistic servitude, why not seek a different way forward? Corbett seems to be optimistic despite the despairing but truthful message he carries. It is worth a read. That's it for this edition of the Global Research News Hour. Thank you for joining us. In the coming week, we will address military preparations by our so-called representatives in government and the media, which is giving it their blessing. And then we will have a few shows during our summer break. Till then, we take care, my friends, and thank you for being a loyal and faithful listener to this show. It is much appreciated. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, a program funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on the traditional lands of the Anishinaabe, the Innu, the Ojibwe, the Dene, and the Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. The show can air on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and is available for streaming or download on the site globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, please email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I've been your host, Michael Welch. Thanks once again for joining us.